Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 252nd episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and this episode is presented by Warner Brothers' critically acclaimed film, A Star Is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper. Starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, the Los Angeles Times says it is, quote, passionate, emotional, and fearless, close quote. For your consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director, A Star Is Born. Great fucking movie. My guest today on Awards Chatter, which is now but one of four podcasts that comprise the Hollywood Reporter's podcast network, the others being It Happened in Hollywood, Behind the Screen, and TV's Top 5, is an actor's actor who is just 33, but already has more than a decade of stage and screen work under her belt and has never given a performance that I don't regard as A grade, Carey Mulligan. The first major film in which Mulligan appeared was 2005's Pride and Prejudice. For her first leading role in a film, namely 2009's An Education, she received a Best Actress Oscar nomination. And she hasn't stopped doing standout work since. Indeed, she shines in 2010's Never Let Me Go, 2011's Drive and Shame, 2013's The Great Gatsby and Inside Llewyn Davis, 2015's Far From the Madding Crowd and Suffragette, 2017's Mudbound, and this year in Wildlife, an indie which Paul Dano and Zoe Kazan co-adapted from Richard Ford's 1990 novel of the same name, and Dano then directed. The film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival and also played at the Cannes, Toronto, and New York Film Festivals. IFC Films began rolling it out theatrically on October 19th, and in their film critics' reviews of the film, the Los Angeles Times called it Mulligan's, quote, career-best performance, close quote, and the New York Times described her turn as, quote, the best performance of any I've seen in film this year. Through it all, Mulligan has frequently returned to the stage, most notably in revivals of The Seagull and Skylight that played at the Royal Court and then transferred to Broadway in 2008 and 2015, respectively, with the latter bringing her a Best Actress in a Play Tony nomination. And this year, she starred in an acclaimed one-woman show off-Broadway called Girls and Boys. No less an authority than the New York Times chief theater critic Ben Brantley has called her, quote, one of the most compelling stage actresses of her generation, close quote. Over the course of our conversation at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter, Mulligan and I discussed all of the above and much more. But first, I was joined at the Westin Times Square in Midtown Manhattan by Emmy winner Christy Jacobson and Roger Ross Williams, the first black director ever to win an Oscar and who also has an Emmy to his name. They are the co-directors of a terrific new documentary short called Take Back the Harbor, which is about the remarkable environmental efforts that are being mounted by high school students and teachers to restore New York Harbor, the horribly polluted waters around the boroughs of the city. The film premiered at the Dock NYC Festival and had a theatrical run that qualified it for consideration for the Best Documentary Short Oscar, and it will also get a televised airing on Discovery on December 18th. Christy and Roger, thank you for joining us.
Thanks
for
having us.
It's great to be here, Scott.
So, you have both made films about such a wide range of topics, and for our listeners, I know that you're aware of this, but just to give a few examples, Christy, everything from Solitary Confinement in 2016's Solitary, which won an Emmy, to Hunger in America in 2012's A Place at the Table, which won the Spirit Awards Truer Than Fiction Award and was nominated for a PGA Award, I believe, to Tut Shore, the restaurateur. I need to go and see. I need to track that one down. Maybe you can help me. In 2006's Toots, which won the NBR Award for Top Doc. Roger, I've known you longer. I haven't met Christy before. So I am able to say, I know you're a man of many interests, but this is quite a range. One film about a remarkable young man with autism. That's, many people will know, 2016's Oscar-nominated Life Animated. To another one about American evangelical missionaries in Africa in 2013's God Loves Uganda. To a Zimbabwean woman who overcomes a disability in 2010's Music for Prudence, the one that you won your Doc Short Oscar 4, which is all to set up the question, how did you guys come to each other and how did you come to this topic?
Yeah, well, Christy and I have known each other for a really long time. I think
over
15 years?
Over 20.
20 years?
Wow. Yeah.
20 years we've known each other. We worked together. We were like assistants together
Where?
A long time ago for a production company.
Yeah.
Where did it start?
Well, no, we got together working on a documentary special that was for People magazine, actually.
Another magazine.
You heard about all the important subjects that we take on.
Yes.
And we were among a kind of motley crew of some of the Well, best and brightest in the documentary world.
Yes.
And we connected there, and we have been friends and kind of following and supporting each other's work for that many years.
But never previously worked together officially?
Never officially.
Okay.
Never officially. The phone call.
Your phone call after you won the Oscar.
Actually, that's right. Christy was the first phone call I made after I won the Oscar, and I was in shock, and I was standing backstage, and I called Christy. I don't even know what I said.
He said, "What just happened?" I said, "You won the Oscar."
That speaks to your relationship, though, that was the first call.
Yes.
And Roger, just for listeners who might be wondering, I will focus on this documentary in a moment, but can we set the record straight about one thing?
Yeah.
Because your documentary short Oscar-winning speech is going to be played for till the end of time. Let's just tell people, there's this historic moment. It's a great moment for anybody to win any Oscar, but to have the first time a black director has ever won an Oscar in any category.
Yep.
And you get up there, and you start speaking for about 10 seconds, if that, and then somebody comes in and ambushes you. What happened?
Former producer came in, ambushed me. I got Kanye'd is what happened.
Before it was fashionable.
Before it was fashionable to get Kanye'd, I was Kanye'd by a former producer, and it was shocking. You know, you're standing up there in front of a billion people, and it's like this horribly embarrassing moment. But, you know, it was actually a blessing in disguise because I got so much attention.
Yes.
Normally during the doc short category, people go out for nachos and go to the bathroom, but they actually watched and talked about it, and I was the number one news story the next day, and the paparazzi was even following me around.
Well, can we ask you, just give you the opportunity here, what would you have said if you had been allowed to finish what you were saying?
Well, I wanted to acknowledge Prudence. You know, I really wanted to acknowledge this girl. And she was there. She had come all the way from Zimbabwe.
This is how Americans behave.
Yes. And, you know, I didn't get the opportunity to do that, but she's an extraordinary woman.
Yes.
So that's what I would have talked about.
Okay. So we know from the fact that Christy was Roger's first call that you guys obviously have a special bond. But when you're going to eventually work together, which may have been something you thought about for a while, why was this the topic that you decided to do it about, Christy?
Roger had just finished making the extraordinary film Life Animated, and I had just finished making the film Solitary, both of which were pretty intense experiences in making them. We shared a producer in Julie Goldman on both those films, and we were kind of throwing around ideas about what was going to happen next, and we were all in like separate conversations with Discovery.
Yes.
And this subject came up, the New York Harbor School.
Who brought it up? Did you guys know about it already?
Well, you know, we live in Manhattan, and we're surrounded by water, and this is a city that, it's an island. We live on an island, but we're not in touch with our environment. We're not in touch with the island we live on and the nature that is all around us. And we sort of use the harbor as a trash can, really.
Yeah.
And so we were like, let's do something about where we live and about saving the place that we live and making it better. And so when we had heard about the Harbor School, a school on Governor's Island for New York City school kids, that's part of the public school system that encourages these kids to get involved with the water that surrounds them, that was really exciting because a lot of New Yorkers are not in touch with this sort of environment, right?
Yeah, I mean, your film begins by having some of the students who are at this school say that until they went there, they rarely saw any nature. You know, when you're in the certain boroughs here, you just see walls and pavement and sidewalks, and you don't even really kind of stop to realize that you are on an island. So, Christy, the aspect of this that's maybe most interesting is the Billion Oyster Project. For our listeners, can you explain what it is that these students are doing with that?
Yeah. So the Billion Oyster Project's goal is to grow and have oysters live and thrive a billion oysters by the year 2035 in New York's harbor.
Yeah.
And that sounds like, okay, so there were very few, in fact, almost zero when they started their project a couple of years ago. So it sounds like an outrageous and impossible dream, which is also partly, I think, what drew both Roger and I to it. Because if something is easy, then that's not exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the idea is that the Harbor School students, who are public high school students, are both getting their high school education at the school on Governor's Island, mm-hmm. but also getting trained in a range of marine professions,
yeah.
aquaculture, marine biology, scuba diving. And they are working together with the founders of the Billion Oyster Project to build these reefs. And over time, and even over the time since we've met them and today, they have gotten 28 million oysters into the harbor.
Oysters filter the water. Oysters filter toxins out of the water, and they filter, how many gallons is it, Christy, per oyster?
A billion oysters would filter the standing water in New York's harbor once every 3 days.
So I had no idea about this. Does this mean when we eat oysters, we're eating all kinds of crap?
Well, they bring it in
yeah.
and then they spew stuff back out
after it's been cleaned or something. Somehow.
Yeah. It's like how they eat. How
most of the oysters you're eating are farmed oysters,
right,
waters are clean.
Yes.
But you couldn't eat oysters out of New York City Harbor.
Would
you
not,
would get
no.
very, very sick. That's actually a challenge with the Billion Oyster Project because they're worried that New Yorkers will actually go down and eat the oysters and then everyone will get sick.
Hey.
So the DEP is very concerned
yeah.
about that. So that was part of the
them.
Challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, some other stats that your film provides, there are now 70 restaurants in New York that are working with the Billion Oyster Project, 70 schools that are engaged with it, 1,215 high school students, 6,500 plus middle school students who are involved with this, as well as 1,000 plus volunteers. My question, I guess, when you're looking at a film like this, do you embark on it knowing this is going to be what technically is called a documentary short, or do you have to see what you're working with before you know whether or not it's going to be a feature length or a short?
We always knew this was going to be a documentary short. We went into it with that in mind, and you sort of, as you're structuring and shooting and thinking about the film, you're thinking that it's structured as a short. And also, with a short, you can sort of put it out there and reach a lot of people, and the schools can use it for educational purposes, mm-hmm. which is really great, mm-hmm. so that school students, you know, with their short attention span,
right.
kids can, you know, they can watch a short in the classroom.
Yeah, it's
so
about
that's
the length of a class, yeah. probably 45, 50
exactly,
minutes.
Exactly. So the Billion Oyster Project goes into New York City schools all around the city. It's not just the school on Governor's Island, but they will go into schools and they will teach kids about their relation to the harbor and about marine biology. So this is a tool for them as well.
And I think what we didn't know is what I at least rarely know when I'm filming is, you know, how we'll structure the film, like how will it all come together? And when I was hearing you read those statistics,
yeah.
I was reminded of our kind of hair-pulling moments of, you know, how to tell that story
yeah.
in a 40-minute film.
Right.
And it became apparent to us once we spent, the more time we spent with the students, and the more we understood, like you just described, a real movement.
Mm-hmm.
Like community is involved, restaurants are involved, students are involved, but not one student. It's not like one leader of the school.
No.
It really was this collective, which is why the film is populated with, you know, some amazing young adults now, Jesse and Gino and Chris Maris, and there's just so many students, and we felt like we needed and wanted all of their stories to help tell the story rather than, you know, just like identifying one student and going on their journey.
It takes a village to save the planet.
Yeah, that's true. And this is proof of that. And it's incredible to think that this might be the most effective way of actually cleaning up what is a disgusting body of water. And your film shows that literally if it rains here too much, it doesn't require Hurricane Sandy to pour tons of feces and other stuff into all kinds of who knows what into the water here, which I think if, you know, these students are not even allowed to go in the water for 3 days after it rains because it's so bad. So it clearly needs to be dealt with, and yet it has not been. So
yeah, it's only a quarter of an inch of rain, then it's overflow.
Triggers
yeah. all the waste,
yeah.
all the poop
yeah.
from
yeah.
all these millions of New Yorkers into the harbor. Think about that. Think about
so
how
disgusting
that is.
Yeah.
There's points all throughout the harbor where it's just pouring
yeah.
in, and all the drain water and everything, all the trash you throw on the streets, all that stuff goes right into the harbor, and here we are surrounded by that.
It seems like a little design flaw there, but I don't know.
Well, that's exactly, yeah. Like,
so how long were you guys on this project from start to finish, and how far along the way did it take before you realized sort of the structure and the individuals that were going to be the center of this?
I think we were on it for a year and a half, right? Around that. And it was probably halfway into the edit, you know, when we tried a number of different ways to tell the story, when it kind of became clear that, you know, as Roger said, it takes a village. Yeah. By the way, it also took a village. We had a team of editors, a team of producers, all of whom were, you know, trying to help us sort it through.
And it's also following the seasons and the school year. There's the actual school year of the students, right, but also the work they do in the summer and also building these like giant sort of oyster beds, and the work they do takes a lot of time and effort, and you have to get a lot of permits. Permitting is like a nightmare for them. So it's a lot of effort to actually get to the point where you're actually building these giant oyster reefs, and that just took time, and we wanted to.
And on top of that, logistically, like, so from a production point of view, generally, if you're shooting people putting oysters in the water outdoors, like, you need good weather or the shoot might be canceled.
Yeah.
For us, we needed good weather that day and the 2 days or 3 days prior. So it was a production feat.
Yeah. A lot of canceled for shoots.
A lot of holds and cancels and holds and cancels. And ultimately, you know, something that happen because, you know, I think a lot of filmmaking is putting yourself in the position to get lucky, to be there to capitalize on things that are happening. And there is a moment in the film where Pete and Jesse, you know, find this really exciting piece of oyster, which is really inspiring piece of information, which was that an oyster
got there on its own.
Yeah. And it was like, it felt like, you know, it just, whoa, we did it. We got it. It's happening.
Do you ever think you'd be that excited about an oyster?
No.
There
you go.
Not
if there wasn't champagne
next to it.
And even when they saw the whale in New York City Harbor, which was like, you know, there's marine life coming back to the New York City Harbor used to be thriving with life. This used to be the oyster. New York, Manhattan was the oyster capital of the world.
Yeah, you would show people eating it by the bucket out of like hot dog stands.
There were carts on every corner. Yeah. Oyster carts. The oyster bar is not named the oyster bar for nothing.
This was
the oyster capital, and people they had oysters the size of dinner plates that they would eat.
It's crazy.
It was the main food in the city.
So what do you hope that people who see this in a theater are probably in many cases on Discovery? What do you hope they leave it thinking or doing differently? Is it just what's needed here? Does this Governor's Island school require financial support? Do they want more recruits? What can be the best way to help their cause?
Well, I think that, you know, not just New Yorkers, but everyone needs to be aware that we have a planet in peril. We have a planet that we are destroying because we don't think of the world in this sort of circular way, that the waste we create and the things we create have to go back into the planet and be recycled. And when people in New York throw trash, there was a kid in the film who talked about their parents throwing trash out of the window of their car driving in the Bronx, and they said they stopped their parents, got out of the car, and picked up the trash. So it is the next generation. They're going to inherit this planet, and they want to save this planet, and that we need to support them. We need to give them the tools. We need to inspire kids to make a difference, but not just kids. All of us need to save the planet we live on, because none of this would be possible. The Oscars and everything would not be possible if we don't have a planet.
That is true. And as long as you bring up the Oscars, I have a question for you, Roger, because you are one of three people on the Academy's Board of Governors representing the documentary branch.
Yeah.
And also, you're the chair of the Doc Branch and the Diversity Committee, and you're on the Academy's Education and Outreach Committee and the A2020 Diversity Initiative. You are the overachiever there.
I know.
Don't mess with Roger.
No.
I'm exhausted.
I bet.
So many meetings.
This is all also from New York, when most of this stuff is happening in L.A., so you're on a lot of speaker phone calls, I guess.
I go to LA a lot for meetings, but I am on a lot of calls.
Right.
I try to go to LA when I can.
No, it's amazing. But so I guess the questions, I just a couple things about that. How would you say the Academy's A2020 initiative, which is basically about increasing the inclusion of the membership, how has that been coming along in your view?
I can only speak for the DOC branch, yes, because I chair the diversity committee there. The DOC branch is way ahead of the other branches, and I could say we're leading the way. We have the most diverse branch out of all the branches in the academy.
In terms of women and
race? In terms of people of color, yep, and women, this year my goal is to reach a 50-50 gender parity in, wow, the DOC branch, which would be just sort of, you know, amazing to do that.
First
because
branch
the world,
to do that.
This is the first branch to do that. And, you know, why shouldn't the academy reflect the real world? You know, why shouldn't especially the DOC branch, which has so many women filmmakers, mm-hmm, like brilliant William and filmmakers like Christy Jacobson, mm-hmm, how are we not at 50-50 or 51%, really? It doesn't make any sense to me. So for me, it's been a big push. It's been a big push internationally to get international members. I also head up the international festival committee in the DOC branch. So, mm-hmm, we have 26 international film festivals, wow, where their features qualify for Academy now. So now we're getting features from countries around, mm-hmm, the world that normally wouldn't qualify because they're not going to play theatrical runs in America. And this is another way to bring in and to engage the world. And also with me, I've sort of diversified the executive committee and brought in international members from around the world to be the people who are making decisions
about who to invite.
About who to invite into the academy. And I hope the DOC branch is the shining example for the future of what the academy can be.
Absolutely. And just for the record, your other two governors of the DOC branch are
Rory Kennedy and, yes, Kate Amend, who, okay, are both absolutely amazing. I mean, look at the DOC branch. We have two incredible women, an amazing editor, an amazing filmmaker, and Rory Kennedy, and an African-American guy. So, you know, like, we're way ahead. The Board of Governors, when I sit around the table, I'm not seeing a lot of black faces and not, mm-hmm, a lot of people of color.
What are you one of how many now?
There's, let's see, Wynn Thomas, Whoopi Goldberg, yeah, myself, Reginald Hudland. I believe that's it.
So definitely some room for improvement in the other branches. Yes.
There's a lot of work to be done, yeah, but at least the academy's doing it. And, yeah, I think as an organization, it's important that we lead the way, that, right, we lead the way in Hollywood, that we lead the way to changing Hollywood and giving opportunities to people who the door has been closed to them. The door had been closed to me, and, right, I want to now open the door since I have a seat at the table. Yep. I have a seat at the table.
The room where it happens.
The room where it happens. I'm in the room, yeah, where it happens. Yeah. And I want to invite other people to the table as well.
Well, so that leads in nicely to the two follow-ups before we move on from this. At the end of June, I believe, your incumbent president, John Bailey, is going to term out, meaning he cannot run for re-election. Then someone else from the Board of Governors is going to have to run for president. Is there any chance that Roger Roth Williams might be a candidate?
You know, no comment. No, I'm not. No, I mean, you know, I'm in New York. The president of the academy is someone that is, because of CBI, Sherbin Isaacs, yes, was very engaged. It's pretty much a full-time job. And you kind of have to be sort of either retired or in semi-retired in order to do that job, because that's a lot of work.
So you're not ready to pack it in yet.
I'm not ready to pack it in and move to LA.
Right. You got to wait till the harbor, at least until the harbor's clean.
Yeah,
Daniel.
Let's get the harbor cleaned up,
right,
first.
Right.
No, but there's a number of probably amazing candidates who are going to run, and it's really exciting to have new leadership and,
right,
change, and,
right,
I welcome that, and I look forward to see what happens.
Final question on that topic is just the board approved a decision a few months ago that is going to pull some of the categories off of being presented on the air. They'll still be presented during commercials, but aired as interstitials coming in or out of the telecast. So they'll still be aired on the telecast. They're just not going to be presented in full. And that, in order to meet the other commitment that you guys made, which is it's going to be no longer than 3 hours, the Oscars telecast, several categories are going to be handled in that way. So, and it looks like it'll be a rotation of which those will be. So for year one of this trial, will documentary feature or documentary short be two of the categories not on the telecast?
I don't know. I think that is up to the producers of the show, Donna Gelati. So I don't know what the producers are going to choose. I know one thing. I know that documentary feature will always be on the show because I will always fight to make sure that documentary feature is in the broadcast. Yes. That is really important. I think that maybe documentary short could go into a rotation. Yep. I don't know what year it would go into that rotation, but documentary feature, absolutely. It's important. I mean, documentaries are all... Look, we had documentaries this year that made over $22 million in the box office. Yeah. We have documentaries doing better than some narrative films.
Right.
So we have documentaries, that make, we have like Won't You Be My Neighbor and RBG and Three Identical Strangers who are making huge money at the box office. So it's time the Academy, really... the Force Academy recognizes documentary, but the Academy, I think, understands how important documentaries are to people and how important that it remain part of the show. And I will fight for that as governor and chair of the documentary branch.
You heard it here.
Yes. Last question goes to both of you guys and whoever wants to jump first. Will there be another Roger Ross Williams, Chris Jacobson collaboration in the near future, or just what is next for you guys?
We will work together again.
Yes, we will work together again. I'm finishing the Apollo documentary.
Awesome, the Apollo Theater. Yes.
Apollo Theater, documentary about the Apollo Theater, and working on my first narrative film.
Yes. So you were just at the Sundance Lab.
Sundance Director's Lab.
Awesome.
I just did the Sundance Director's Lab, which was fun and challenging and amazing. And I love everyone, Michelle Satter and everyone over there at Sundance. They have, Redford was incredible, just an incredible mentor.
Yep.
So I'm excited for that next chapter, and I hope Christy and I actually will get to do something together, and we will, because we'll always be close, because we always have that, from that first phone call after I won the Oscar till now, we're bonded forever.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. And I'm working on a couple of new projects, including a new feature that I'm really excited about but can't talk about.
Got it.
And a series. And I also just wanted to mention, when you asked about sort of the takeaway for Take Back the Harbor, I think one of the things that's like a hidden message, if you will, although I'm outing it now, is just like when we experienced all these kids, like, so they're literally from different boroughs. They're from different types of homes.
Yeah.
They're very different. They might have different religions. They all came together because, as Roger said, the planet is in peril.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked together for that purpose. And I thought, for me, that was like a really important thing to be a part of, to witness myself, to be a part of myself, and to remind people that this is possible, that we're not, we don't need to accentuate our differences as much as we can come together to solve, these kinds of problems.
Well, thank you guys for the very interesting information in the film and for coming in today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
And now for my interview with Carey Mulligan. All right, Carey, thank you so much for doing this. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Absolutely. We always begin with just a few basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born in London and sort of lived there for a couple of years, and then we moved to Germany and then back again when I was 7 or 8. And my parents, my dad was a hotel manager, and my mum worked in hotels as well, but stopped working for a little bit when I was a kid.
And that was the reason for all the traveling around, the moving around.
Yeah.
So what is your earliest memory of taking interest in performance of any sort?
Quite late, I think, but I think I was 6 years old. I was at the International School of Dusseldorf in Germany, and my brother was doing a school production of The King and I.
Okay.
And I remember going with my mum to pick him up from rehearsals one afternoon quite early into the rehearsals, and I saw them all up on stage and thought it looked really fun, and I was really jealous, and I was too young to be in it. I wasn't in the right year, but I kicked up such a fuss that they let me in, and that was the first play that I ever did, I think.
And then who is Mrs. J?
Mrs. J! Oh, Mrs. J. Mrs. J was my, it's Mrs. Jacobson. She was my teacher at my first primary school when I came back to England when I was 8. And she is this incredible Scottish woman. And I was in the school choir and the church choir. So she sort of taught me to sing and kind of, ushered me into performing, I guess.
Like coming out of your shell a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, sort of like nudging me in the back, making me sing louder.
So what do you think it was then that you responded to about performing that made it this growing idea throughout your childhood to the point where, you know, you were wanting to do it professionally by the time you were taking your A-levels?
I think literally that it looked like the most fun. You know, I can't remember wanting to do it. It wasn't, you know, I kind of, because you get asked about it, and I think I've thought about it a decent amount here and there, but I think it just comes down to the fact that it looked like the most fun thing. It was way more fun than academia, and I was, right. You know, I got by in school, but I wasn't wildly academic like my brother, and it just looked really fun, and like it was a great gang to be a part of, and I wanted to be a part of it.
And yet, you're not from a showbiz family, didn't know other actors, so yeah. What was the mechanism for trying to find out how this all, you know, worked if you wanted to try to get into it?
I mean, I had no clue. I was kind of looking at, I mean, I remember I auditioned to be a children's TV presenter when I was 14. You know, I was kind of coming at it from all angles. I didn't necessarily, I knew that was the wrong thing, but I didn't know if it would be a pathway into acting. But I mean, really, I wanted to be a musical theatre actress. So I imagined that I would get to the point when I left school where I would just start going to big open castings. And then I realised that you have to like actually really be able to sing to do that. So that was a giant disappointment. But yeah.
Was there some letter writing that occurred?
Oh, there was letters. Oh, yes.
Who might still have a copy?
I mean, I'm sure no one has a copy, but the people I wrote to, I mean, I wrote to Julian Fellowes. He was the person who really kind of helped me right at the beginning. I wrote to Kenneth Branagh. I wrote to Eminem. Never got a response.
Really?
Yeah. I wrote a fan letter to Eminem, really.
But just about because of the music side, or was he already into movies?
He had just done 8 Mile.
So that was the catalyst.
I know. Yeah.
But Julian Fellowes was, like, it sounds like, the first actor who you actually, or first professional actor who you actually met. People today know him mostly as the guy behind Downton Abbey, but he's also an actor.
Yeah.
And how did you first come to interact with him, and how did that actually kind of help to get things started?
So I was the head of drama at my school, obviously. It's a massive loser. And he came to our school because he knew our headmistress, and he came and he gave a talk to the whole school about winning the Oscar for Gosford Park. And so because I was head of drama, I got to sit with him at dinner afterwards. And I said, I want to be an actress. And he said, well, you should marry a banker or a lawyer. And I was like, cheers.
Yeah.
Sage advice. But no, but he was great. But, you know, we had a really interesting conversation. But then, you know, cut to a year later, I had applied to and not gotten into drama school and was headed to go to university and didn't want to go. And so I wrote to him and said, you know, we met and I'm not really sure how to, you know, I know that I won't last in university because I'll just drop out and waste everyone's time, and I want to be an actor, but I don't know any way in.
Right.
And so he had obviously got lots of these letters, and he took me out to dinner with his wife and with about 7 other people who'd all written letters, who wanted to be writers and directors and actors as well. And they kind of, yeah, I mean, they sent me off to audition for Pride and Prejudice, basically. I auditioned for Gina Jay's assistant, Robin. And Robin coached me through the audition because I had only ever been on stage, so obviously everything I did was huge, and Robin was sort of like gesturing me to do less and less and less. And very luckily, I got that job.
Right. Just to go back for a second, though, to the applying to drama school, it sounds like from stuff I've read that, like a lot of parents, yours were not thrilled about the idea that you would go into this professionally.
Yeah.
And so when you applied, it was sort of a covert thing, right?
Yeah.
And when that did not pan out, was that kind of crushing? Because, I mean, that could have dissuaded a lot of people from even continuing to pursue this.
It was crushing. I mean, yeah, in my dream version of it, I secretly applied. I went to the audition and I got a place at RADA, and I came home and dropped the letter on the table and said, boom, there you go. Right. I'm a genius. And and obviously that didn't happen. So I was disappointed, but I also recognized the crazy competition, and I knew that I wasn't as good as some of the people. And you watch everyone in lots of these places, you sit like at Lambda or at Central. I watched 10 other people audition, and I saw 3 other people who were like phenomenally good. And
so you didn't disagree with their
no I was
decision.
Like, you're quite right, I shouldn't come, I'm not as good as those people. So it sort of made sense to me. So I was disappointed, because I think you always dream that the version of it will work out that you imagine, but I wasn't, you know, it made sense to me, and I knew that it wasn't enough to sort of make me quit.
Well, so fortunately the Fellows angle leads to the casting director, which leads to Pride and Prejudice, which, just to remind people, you're playing Kitty Bennett, the youngest sister of Elizabeth Bennett, who was played by Keira Knightley. You've also got Rosamund Pike in there. We've recently had Keira and Rosamund on this podcast as well. And talking to them about Pride and Prejudice, it sounds like for them, at least, it may never be as good as it was making that one. Not in terms of the part or whatever, but just the experience. They seem to suggest that, you know, to have that many young actresses who all get along, who are spending a summer together, roughly the same age, everybody, it sounds like, was falling in love with somebody, you know, and making a very good movie. Yeah. Is that over romanticizing it, or was that really, because for your first film role, if that's the case, that might...
No, that really was. Yeah. And actually, I saw Roz last night, and we both said that, you know, and it was kind of extraordinary. And we were all between 18 and 25 and living in these, you know, beautiful country houses and spending our summers running around fields together. And there was something so idyllic about it. And I think it set us up. You know, it was interesting. I then went on my next job as a play at the Royal Court, the Kevin Elliott play, and it was really dark and I played a rape victim and I had narcolepsy and, you know, and I was like, what is this job? I don't understand. I've just been having barbecues all summer. And now you know, it was just really odd. And it was Katie Mitchell. It was a brilliant, you know, piece of work to be a part of. But it was like, I can't get my head around what this is, because Pride and Prejudice was, and nothing will ever be the same as that. Right. Again, that was a really singular experience.
So another aspect of that was special, I think, was that there's another person who's in that movie who you share a scene with, Dame Judi Dench. And talk about the role she had played in your imagination prior to working with her, and then what the actual experience, you know, was like in comparison.
Yeah, I mean, she has been, is, will always be my hero. So I grew up sort of dreaming about working with her. And I remember having vivid dreams about working with her, and then waking up and realizing that I was 14 and that it wasn't, you know, a reality, and being really crushed, you know. So she was is my favorite actress on the planet. And then, yeah, so bizarrely, day one of rehearsals on Pride and Prejudice, she walks up to me and says, "My name's Judy. I believe we have the same agent," which we do still today. And I was just like, the heck is going on? And even on set, we came to shoot the first scene with her, and it's the scene where she shows up in our house in the middle of the night, and it's a big wide shot of the whole family looking at her. And Joe Wright came up to me and was like, "You are not doing anything with your face. You just look shocked.
Stunned,
you
yeah.
need to do. You need to act." I couldn't get right. my head around it. Yeah, it was
amazing.
Yeah.
So after Pride and Prejudice, you had now been in a movie, but it's not like you were yet a movie star. You were doing other things that I just going to mention a few on TV, BBC miniseries Bleak House, an episode of Doctor Who that sort of presaged having a female Doctor Who, then some smaller parts in movies like Brothers for Jim Sheridan, which I think was the beginning of you and Jake Gyllenhaal knowing each other, Public Enemies for Michael Mann. But it sounds like the real turning point was actually on the stage with The Seagull, playing Nina, the aspiring young actress in that. That was first at the Royal Court, then on Broadway, just like years later, I think, Skylight. Ben Brantley says, actually recently, quote, Ben Brantley, the chief theater critic of the New York Times, says that yours was, quote, the best Nina I've seen, close quote. And David Hare and others had echoed that. How did you come to be cast in such a major part after having not really played big parts anywhere before? And then also, how did it change the way you approach acting? Because it sounds like, from things I've read, that, you know, it really did. You're not just going to kind of imagine yourself in the experience of, or, you know, relate your own experiences to the character.
Yeah, I'd worked at the Royal Court before. My first play was there, so I sort of knew that space. I was shooting an ITV production of Northanger Abbey with Felicity Jones.
Oh, really?
And so I auditioned for it right before we went off to shoot that. And it was around the time that I'd shot that Doctor Who episode. And I went in and I did the audition, and I think I went back in again. And yeah, it was a completely life-changing experience for me. And, you know, one of my favourite roles I've ever played. There was something so romantic about that whole experience. But I think it was working with Ian Rickson. I think prior to that, everything I'd done, I'd been kind of winging it, you know, in a way. And just, you know, if I ever had to emote, I would sort of imagine terrible things happening to my family. Or, you know, I just didn't really ever kind of, I suppose I wasn't really creating characters so much as just sort of playing versions of myself, or I suppose maybe part of you always does that. But with Nina, her experience was so removed from mine. But there were things that I felt a real affinity to. But, you know, she had had a baby and lost the baby and, you know, was living in a garret in, you know, Russia. And there were just so many things that I couldn't sort of directly draw experience from. So with Ian, we sort of built this character up. And it was when I started sort of pulling together music and poetry and prose and things to sort of help me build a different life for a character.
Was that also, I think that you do collages or something, right?
Well, it's more, yeah, it's more sort of like I found lots of amazing sort of images, lots of artwork, Russian poetry. You know, sometimes if you do a long theatre run, and we did 8 weeks in London, 16 weeks in New York, I think you sometimes need to have new stories to tell, even when you're saying the same lines over and over again to sort of make it. So that was all part of that, really.
Got it. So from that, I don't know if it was as a result of that or just kind of coincidental, but you get an opportunity to audition for this part of a underage English school girl who is courted by a considerably older guy in Lona Scherfig's An Education, 2009. Mm. How did it first cross your radar, and was it immediately clear that it was something you really wanted to go after?
Yeah, I mean, it was. It was a funny thing because it went on, I think, for more than a year, maybe 18 months, 2 years. It was sort of around for a while, and it had a different director attached. I auditioned for the original director.
Oh, really?
It had a different name. It was called The Best Time of Her Life. So I'm glad they changed the title. And then it went away for a while. And then I think it came back and they were talking to me. They were saying, well, maybe you should come in and audition for Helen. Maybe you've aged out of that role.
The one that Rosamund eventually played.
Which is the part that Rosamund played. But I went back in for Jenny and I read with Peter. I mean, I loved it and I was so excited to do it. But it just felt like, you know, it didn't feel like a giant leap from the stuff I'd been doing. And I'd never played a lead in a film before. But in my expectation for that film was like maybe a week at the Mayfair Curzon. You know, I didn't imagine it would ever get seen, so I didn't feel any kind of pressure doing it. And it was so fast and, you know, but yeah, it was an amazing experience.
Did the fact that you were in it or Rosamund was in it, what came first? Because I think Rosamund was saying were you living with her and Joe Ray at the time that you were auditioning or something? She said you were like kind of trying to figure out a way to survive in LA on buses or something.
Oh, yeah, I did live with them for a bit. Yeah, I lived with them for a while. Like a month, I think. And that was my bus time. My infamous bus time.
I don't think you concluded that it's a viable option, right?
Well, you know, I made it. It was actually good because I didn't know anyone here apart from them. So it was a kind of handy way to fill a day because you can, you know, spend like a day going to two meetings if you're on the bus. Yeah, so I did. I lived with them for a bit. I think it was around, it's kind of hard to remember. I remember Joe doing a read, like a read through of The Soloist in his living room. And I handed out the scripts and was making tea.
Not reading any?
Not reading it. No, I was not invited to be an actor in that. No. Yeah, so I think it must have been around that time. I came on board first, I think, and then Roz came on, and Roz and Dominic came on kind of quickly after.
Right.
And then it all came together very fast when it actually happened.
So while I know the film makes a point of showing that your character is a willing and eager participant in everything that happens in this relationship, especially the physical stuff, I still can't help but wonder if that movie would even get made today in the post-Me Too. What do you think?
Yeah, do you know what? I haven't thought about that. Yeah, maybe not. I don't know. It's hard to... There were definitely things that, you know, people cringed about and felt uncomfortable about, you know, even at the time. I suppose it's interesting to look at those uncomfortable things, though. I mean, I think it would be a shame if we started editing those things out because they are truthful. And she was not in jeopardy. And she had agency and she was making choices. I mean, some of them were misguided, but we all make misguided choices. So I'd be concerned if we started not telling stories about sort of, you know, mistakes.
Unpleasant things. Yeah. So the movie debuts at Sundance, goes over very well there, thanks largely to your performance, sells for $3 million, which is a lot of money for an indie, two Sony classics, I think, you know, Oscar noms for picture and yourself and all kinds of stuff. And suddenly you are the it person. And we actually, the only prior time I think that I'd done a proper sit down interview with you was in February 2010. I pulled up the transcript. Was in the midst of that evening where you and other breakthrough actors were being honored at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival in your green room there, I guess. Yeah. And I pointed out at that time that the last time a youthful looking 24-year-old with a short haircut got a Best Actress Oscar nomination for her first leading role in a film in which she meets a man who helps her to escape from the only life she's ever known and see the world anew before returning to where she came from, that person was Audrey Hepburn for Roman Holiday. So, and people were actually often at that time comparing you to her and to Jean Seberg and to others. Just how did you handle that whole moment where it was all starting to blow up, I guess, just personally and professionally?
You know what? The problem was, I think I just took it all way too seriously. I mean, I didn't buy any of that. Like, that all just felt crazy. And, you know, and I felt sort of clumsy. And when people compare you to Audrey Hepburn, it's the only thing that can make you feel worse about yourself, because the drastic, vast difference between me and Audrey Hepburn is, you know, evident. Do you know what? It was amazing because it got me the opportunity to work with directors and opened up doors to jobs that I would never have had any access to. I think probably in retrospect, I'd go back and be like, 24-year-old me, relax. It's a red carpet. Don't cry about it. You know, nobody cares tomorrow whether you fall over or not, or if you say something stupid. Like, there's bigger things in life. But I did not feel that way at the time. I felt sort of freaked out by the whole thing and felt like, what am I doing in a room with these people?
Was Colin Firth kind of your buddy through that?
Colin Firth was my, yeah, he was my bodyguard and protector and everything else. Yeah.
I think that was that season he was going with a single man. So you guys. So in terms of what came about directly as a result of an education, I think the first thing was Never Let Me Go, where you're back with Kira. People like to claim credit for things that they didn't do often. I don't know. So I don't know if this is true, but I read something where Peter Rice, who was then the head of Fox Searchlight, now runs all of Fox, said that it was his idea to have Mark Romanek reach out to you about being in that. I guess he was in the middle of watching an education and knew that Mark needed to, was having a hard time casting this part of Kathy H. How do you remember it coming about?
No, that's true.
That is true.
Yeah, he emailed Mark during the screening, I think.
Really?
Or just after it had finished in Sundance. And it was like, it was like 2 weeks later, I think, that I met Mark, I think in New York, and read for Kathy. So yeah, that's accurate.
And so at that time, the only people that would have seen your work in education would have been the people that saw it at Sundance.
Yeah, yeah, people who were in there, yeah.
2011, just the year after Never Let Me Go, which went over really well, Toronto and all these, you know, on the festival circuit again that you had done with an education. Now you had a crazy year with two that I've got to ask you about. This character of Irene in Nicholas Winding Refn's Drive, and then Sissy in Steve McQueen's Shame, not to mention Off-Broadway Through a Glass Darkly. Let's start with Drive. This movie just oozes coolness. It's I think people think it's the coolest thing. I agree. And it's you as a mother raising her kid while her husband's in jail. Ryan Gosling's this enigmatic guy who shows up on the scene, comes into their lives, premiered at Cannes, has become very loved. But it's also, I would imagine on paper, hard to explain what that movie ended up being. It's a very stylized, very, I mean, I just think about the scene in the elevator where he slow-mo, like, kisses you and pushes you back and somebody's head gets bashed in, and it's insane. So how did you know that this was actually worth aligning yourself with?
Oh, I just wanted to work with Nicholas. I think I'd seen Bronson and I was completely blown away by Bronson, and I saw Valhalla Rising, and that was it. I just wanted to do whatever he was doing next. And then when I found out that he was doing that, I went and auditioned for it.
Shame was another one that I think you really went after. Just to remind people, it's one of like the I guess ballsiest would not be the best word to use in this context, but it's a very ballsy movie. NC-17 look at sex addiction, centers on two very messed up siblings who, you know, everybody has their issues, but these guys have some pretty serious issues. One of them played by Michael Fassbender, and then the other played by you. Fassbender and McQueen were coming off of Hunger together. Was that the appeal for you of this, or why? I mean, I read that you really went after that one.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I read it and I just thought it was so brilliant. And I thought Steve was so brilliant. I think she seemed like such a tricky, tricky character to figure out. And there was so much complexity to her. And I didn't know what her story was. And I was so fascinated by her relationship with her brother. And I didn't think Steve would let me do it. I thought, you know, he would sort of see me in an education, see me in Bleak House or Northanger Abbey and these like kind of more polite period dramas, and I, you know, but I felt like I could do that part. And I was conscious of not becoming a British actress who just wears corsets, and I didn't want that. So yeah, so I remember we had coffee and he kept on sort of calling an end to the meeting and saying, like, well, cool, it was nice to meet you. I kept saying, well, but no, but just thing is, though, just if you just hang on for a minute, because I, and then like scrambling to try and think of something else.
Trying to get ready.
Well, I think he was like, you know, he'd, you know, I don't know if he'd sort of made up his mind or maybe he hadn't, but in my mind, I was like, the longer he stays here, the better chance I have of getting this gig. And so in the end, he said, I've got to go to a meeting. And I was like, well, where's your meeting? And he said, I'm going to Soho. I was like, no way, I'm going to Soho. I'll come with you. So we got in the same taxi. Yeah, it was kind of harassing.
Did you end up with a tattoo as a result of that meeting?
Yeah, I did.
Why, what is that about?
Well, we were sort of, you know, I think he was quite challenging in a way. And I love that about Steve. And he was like that when we filmed together. And I think it's part of what makes him such an incredible director is he just challenges you constantly and doesn't ever let you rest on your laurels. And he was sort of challenging me about what I wanted to do and how I wanted to kind of expand. And I was talking, I think I ended up talking a lot about Nina. And what I found so exciting about Nina was that the difficulty of that character, she's just, it's just a really difficult character to pull off. And I felt like I sort of never cracked it, but I felt like what I loved so much was trying to crack the nut. And so I said, you know, and in fact, I think I'm going to get a tattoo. And he was like, are you? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, go on, then get your tattoo. And I was like, okay.
And if you do, yeah, then he was going to, that, well, was like basically the deal sealer.
I don't know if it ever would have made a difference, but you know, there was just something sort of like, he's provocative and, right, and challenging. And that's, I think, what gets this incredible kind of energy out of people in his work.
We just had him on here a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things I asked him about, I want to ask you about as well. To me, it was the most thought-provoking scene in the film. Fassbender's character returns to his apartment, busts into the bathroom thinking he's confronting an intruder, only to find it's you, his sister, who he had lent a key to. His character and yours sort things out while you are still completely naked there, not attempting to cover yourself up, which is not exactly the way most siblings would handle the situation. And it raised two questions in particular for me. So first, on a Carrie Mulligan level, was that a scene that you had to really deeply consider when you were deciding whether or not to go after this? And then on a character level, what did you decide in your own mind that scene reflected about those siblings' relationship?
So on a me level, I didn't think about it really. I mean, it wasn't a decision. It was part of the job. And Steve's an artist, and he's, of all the directors in the world, he would be, you know, someone I would trust the most in that situation. So it never felt like anything, you know. I'm very cautious of things like that. I'm not keen. I mean, I won't wear a bikini on a beach, you know. I'm really not kind of inclined to do that kind of stuff. And I don't believe in anything gratuitous on film. I'm really kind of deliberate about that. But with this character, it felt like, well, yeah, that's who she doesn't give a shit. And that's her, you know, that's how she feels about her body, for good or ill. Like, she's not going to cover herself up. And this isn't about looking a certain way. And in fact, I spent weeks before kind of eating whatever I wanted to, drinking beer, like doing whatever, because she was an alcoholic and she didn't care about how she looked. And so there was something actually kind of remarkably freeing about not playing someone who didn't care. And just,
but is it more than not caring? Is that the way that those characters handle that situation? Is that something that to you suggested that they had a history of incest or sexual abuse, or did you have to figure that out in your own mind?
I mean, I think we had conversations between us, me and Michael and Steve, about it. I mean, I don't think it was incest necessarily, but certainly they came from damaged past. You know, there were certainly, I think there's sort of backstory of abuse there and, you know, a sort of blurring of boundaries because of that. But I didn't feel it was ever a relationship between the two of them.
Right. How about the one other scene I've got to ask you about is just, I think it'll be in every tribute reel to you till the end of time, is the scene with the slowed down, stripped back, haunting rendition of New York, New York. It goes on for like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Most of it is you in a close up, except for some cutaways to Michael's character displaying emotion for the first time in the film. I guess, again, for you doing it, and then also the significance of it, what do you understand it to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think doing it was kind of amazing. I was so, that was probably more nerve-wracking than being naked for the first scene, because it was so exposing and it was all held in one shot. So we shot it, I think, I don't know, 5 or 6 times, one take, and we shot everything live. So it was always going to be kind of very sort of scary. And And I loved prepping for it. It was great getting to work with, you know, a composer and to spend the time sort of doing singing lessons and all that thing. I think it was the only way that she kind of is able to communicate with him, and the only time he really receives it, because he's so happy to block her out all the time and sort of put her down and ignore her and push her off. And this felt like she's got his attention. There's no one, there's no hiding now, that she could, it's the only way she can sort of tell him how she's feeling. It was amazing. Later on in that, we finished that and it was done, and I, you know, breathed a huge sigh of relief. And then Steve came up to me and said, so she can't just have sung one song, so you need to sing another song. I said, all right, well, what do you want me to sing? And he was like, oh, I don't know, but it can't be anything anyone knows, and it can't be a song that's been written or anything, because we can't get the rights.
So he wants you to make up a song.
So he was like, and I was like, all right, so you would just like me to make up a song? He was like, yeah, you're an artist, aren't you? So just make up a song. And so, you know, again, I was like, well, all right.
Oh, man.
So then I sort of made up two lines of like the worst jazz song you've ever heard in your life and sang that and then finished it.
That was just like a transition into like as if she was going on to the next.
And before she moved, and she sits down and has the conversation with Michael.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So I guess probably no more innocent young girl roles after that. But the next thing that happened, I think, would have been a different sort of movie than anything up to that point, different scale, where you, a Brit, beat out every big name actress in Hollywood for the part of one of the most iconic American characters there is, Daisy Buchanan in The Great Gatsby, which Baz Luhrmann was doing here. This is sort of the great American novel. This showman is going to do, again, a very stylized version of. Why did you want it, and what did you have to do to get it?
I wanted to work with Baz, and I wanted to work with Leonardo, and I thought the book was incredible. I'd never read the book. It's not mandatory reading in the UK like it is here. And so it was, I kind of discovered the book in the same time as auditioning for that. And I fell completely in love with the book. And the audition was amazing. I had so much fun.
It was you with Leo.
It was me with Leo, and it was Baz, and Baz is, you know, and he had like cameras, and, you know, he was taking photos, and there were like three different cameras, and it was so fluid and fun. It was like doing theatre, and then I went back in, I think the next day or the day after that, and they put me in full hair and makeup, and we did like this little mini photo shoot, me and Leo. Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, it was like completely surreal, like utterly surreal.
And how about a little daunting though? I mean, just to know that it's such a famous property, people have in their minds who these characters are and what they look like.
Yeah.
The prior version had not really been successful decades earlier. Here it's going to be you with, you know, sort of the person who I think most people imagine today when they think of a movie, the biggest movie star, Leo, with all of this huge budget and scale riding on you guys. Was it at all intimidating to get involved with?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, but like, I was completely blown away. And I went into the audition weirdly not that nervous, because I thought, like, there's no way in hell I'm going to get this, so I may as well just have fun acting with Leonardo DiCaprio for an hour. Like, that's, you know, what an experience. So, yeah, it was. But Baz is incredible at making people feel comfortable, and so is Leo. Like, to be the biggest movie star on the planet, but also, you know, you feel like you're on stage with an actor who's been sort of plugging it away, playing, you know, he's so committed.
Right.
It's amazing. And never once did I feel like, you know, there is an old sort of thing where, you know, if you're not on camera, there's some part of you that probably gives about 10% less because you know that you're not being filmed.
Right.
He doesn't do that.
Right.
Like, if he's off camera, he's doing exactly what he did, if not more than he did when he was on.
It's interesting you say that, because when Margot was saying that about her audition for Wolf of Wall Street, just that you don't expect that from even a lesser actor.
No.
But
and so it's incredible. So it was, it was amazing to work with him.
So how about the type of work that you do in a movie that's of that size? Is it as possible to protect and sort of be as specific with a performance when you have so much else going on around you, such a giant machine, as you can do on a indie?
I don't know. You know, this was different in that it was the first time I'd ever been required to sort of look a certain way. I think I'd never really had to play someone who was sort of the subject of, or the object of, anyone's desire. I'd always sort of played, well, that was never really important before. So I think I probably felt an added, there was probably a self-awareness to that for me. But then she's very self-aware. So I think sometimes these things can help you, even though they feel like problems at the time. I mean, certainly, you know, there's a huge machine going on around you. But Baz, again, like, the way that he works is very creative. It doesn't feel you know, he makes an environment and then allows you kind of play. It just feels very real because you're surrounded by literally hundreds of people. But yeah, I probably felt like somewhat dwarfed by it on occasion when I allowed my kind of insecurities to come into it. But the experience as a whole was incredible.
And watching it, was it fun? I remember I haven't covered Cannes every year, but that was my first time ever at Cannes. Mm. And the opening night was you guys. Mm. It was pouring, but it was just this whole big, like the movie, just a very splashy whole event. And I wonder, you know, to see yourself in that kind of a movie for the first time might be kind of cool.
Well, I remember about 2 years later being in London and going for a run. And I can't remember why, but my mind sort of wandered to that. And I thought, I can't believe I was in that film. It's so weird. And like, it's still weird that I was in that film. And I think there was something so, standing on the red carpet with Leo and Toby and Baz and, you know, and being as a cast, that incredible cast was totally surreal. And even now it sort of feels like otherworldly to, you know.
That same year was a very different scale movie, but with another great, in this case, filmmakers, plural, with the Coen brothers, Inside Llewyn Davis. You're playing not a huge part, but this woman, Jean, a folk singer who is very pissed at the loser who may have knocked her up. It's not clear whether it was him or somebody else. Sometimes, obviously, movies get made and then released in different orders. But was that a response, or were the movies that came after Gatsby a response to Gatsby? Like, let's hunker down and go back to some more smaller scale
stuff. I came over to LA for, I think, something like the Hollywood Awards or something for Shame. Yeah. And it was that weekend I flew over from Sydney. I was shooting Gatsby and I did an audition tape in my hotel room for the Coen brothers. And so I got the job when I was shooting Gatsby, and I wrapped Gatsby like the February, jumped on a plane, went to New York and recorded the soundtrack for Inside Llewyn Davis. And then I think shortly after we shot. So I took off my sort of blonde Daisy wig and put on my Jean wig was swearing, you know, like a trooper. And that was amazing. I never in a million years imagined I would be in a Coen Brothers film. It felt like a totally different and somehow very American and maybe just sort of an inaccessible to a British actor, or I felt like it was to me, and particularly in that kind of part. But yeah, it was, I mean, it was just amazing. And to work with Oscar again, because I'd worked with Oscar on Drive and then worked with him on that.
That is one of their best movies. I love that. But beyond that then, was it you haven't gone and done, unless I'm blanking, another kind of Gatsby scale, big studio, glossy movie. Not that there's anything wrong with those in many cases, but is that just the way it's worked out, or is that a deliberate thing on your part?
I think it's kind of maybe a bit of both. I mean, Gatsby was a big glossy studio thing, but it also had like complete integrity and a brilliant story and unbelievable cast and, you know, a genius director. So it was sort of budget scale wise, you know, a big movie, but it was also felt very kind of artistic at the center of it. And I think probably I haven't found that same combination again since then. So it's not a case of avoiding the size of a film. It's more just finding the right kind of part within it. Like, there hasn't been the right role necessarily.
So continuing to move towards the present, there was a movie that I, in 2015, that I did not, I'll be honest, expect to like, and then I really did a lot, and that is Far From the Madding Crowd. It was a remake of the 67 version with Julie Christie, which was, of course, also both adapted from the Thomas Hardy 1874 novel. You're playing Bathsheba, I remember how you say it, Everdeen, who probably the reference for most people today is she's the namesake of Katniss in The Hunger Games. But I just thought it was, I mean, Vinterberg to come from The Hunt, I think a year earlier, which is one of the darkest and unbelievable movie, but like you would never believe if somebody showed a doubleheader that it was the same guy that made this lush, beautifully shot kind of feminist movie. And I guess I just wonder what convinced you that he could make such a leap, and also to go and do another British period piece costume drama when you, like you said, you kind of wanted to avoid those.
I suppose I wasn't looking for him to make that much of a leap, because I feel like Thomas Hardy is dark and he's not Jane Austen, and a lot of the content, like, there's some crazy stuff happens in that book, and so I wasn't looking for him to make a giant leap. And I think, you know, his aesthetic, he had the same incredible cinematographer Charlotta on both, and so I think there were lots of things that I really wanted to for him to retain for that film. So I was excited to work with him, because I thought, I mean, I remember walking out of The Hunt and just being speechless for literally 20 minutes. Yeah. Like, I just couldn't talk. I just thought it was so incredible. So I wasn't looking to do a period drama at all, but I couldn't pass up the opportunity to work with him because I thought he was just completely brilliant. So, yeah, and I loved it. It was sort of a completely romantic, magical time filming in Dorset in this like stunning landscape and these brilliant male actors that I was getting to work with.
And I wonder if this is coincidental, but, you know, that's a very, as I kind of referenced a second ago, a very, I don't know what the word, feminist aware, obviously it's pre-feminism, but aware character, as is another one that you did that year, Suffragette, for where you're playing a working class woman who at a great personal cost reluctantly joins the British women's rights movement in the early 1900s. Was there a point here somewhere along the way where you decided, you know, it's not only the part itself, but it's what it says socially that's important to say? Or is it just happens that, because I know that you in your own life have been outspoken about some of these things. So is that just being drawn into those conversations because you made the movies, or were the conversations what led you to the movies?
I think they are the most interesting parts. And I loved the idea of Bathsheba being a kind of woman out of her time. And in fact, when that book was released, it was panned by the critics because, you know, a Victorian audience felt that she was such an unlikable, but unrealistic, unrealistic character, because, of course, a woman wouldn't behave like that, which I kind of loved about it. So, yeah, I think that was attractive. And Suffragette, really, I just couldn't fathom that no one had told that story. I think 100 years down the line, and a woman threw herself in front of a horse and died, and hundreds of women went on hunger strike and died so that we could have the right to have their children taken away or abused by the police or countless other things, and we'd never talked about it. And I couldn't believe, I mean, it's so ripe for filmmaking. I couldn't believe it hadn't been told. So I think there was, you know, there's obviously a part of you. I felt sort of my feminism sort of reignited by working on that, and not least because I was surrounded by women making it, and we all sat there and looked around, and as you know, it was the first time I'd had other actresses to work with since Pride and Prejudice, you know, really. Wow. I mean, Kira and I will never let me go, but a group of actresses to be around.
Including Meryl Streep. Just that people may have heard of her. So, and the third and final thing I'll ask about 2015 is something that I and my mom, who's back there, went and saw and loved on Broadway, which is Skylight, a revival with Bill Nighy, who had been in the original, by David Hare. Again, Royal Court to Broadway. Let's just go over what you deal with here. I mean, again, a sort of socially outspoken character, cooking a meal, I think a full meal every performance, while hiding the fact that you were pregnant. Yeah. That's got its own complexities, too.
So I was
Tony nomination, by the way.
I wasn't pregnant in London, thank God.
Right.
But no, we did it in London. And we actually did it at the Wyndhams in London. So we were in the West End. And yeah, I remember Bill came into rehearsals on day one off book. Yeah. And I'd just come off Suffragette. I didn't know any of the words. And I had to learn how to cook spaghetti bolognese in real life because I'm a terrible cook. And then also to do it in the show. And I had to make spaghetti bolognese on stage every night. Yeah, and we had so much fun. I mean, it was the best job ever. And then we took it to Broadway the following year. And I was pregnant, and I told Stephen Daldry and David Hare in rehearsals, and when we were re-rehearsing the show in London, that I was pregnant, and they were very nice about it. I think David went white. But
Rudin probably had some thoughts too, right?
I think he probably did. But I was so lucky because I managed to sort of vaguely keep it under wraps until about the last 2 weeks of the show.
Right. Well, you were nice enough to do our Tony's Actress Roundtable that year that we did in New York, and I think it was Helen Mirren and a whole group of amazing people. And one of the things that we brought up was just how people, how they react to entrance applause, and then also how they deal with the end of their show. And I remarked upon the fact that at the end of that show, because it's basically this two-hander where it's, I'm sure, very draining, you did not look like the happiest camper by the end, by the bows. And I wonder, though, you know, that is, these things, 8 times a week, I think, in that case, I don't even remember if there was an intermission. I forget.
There was.
Not for the most recent. But, I mean, why subject yourself to that?
I ask myself that same question sometimes, sort of halfway through the run. I mean, it's just my favorite thing in the world to do, and I miss it when I don't do it. And it's what I wanted to do when I was little, so it feels like wish fulfillment to get to do it. It's complete escapism and my favorite thing in the world. I'm sort of never really happier than when I'm working on stage. So I pine for it if I go too long without doing it. And there's kind of nothing really like it, sort of. You know, I don't think you can immerse yourself in the same way when you're on set being filmed. And so it's just my favorite thing.
Nice. Well, the last pre-Wildlife movie that I'm going to ask you about is one that came out last year and really had a lot of people talking and probably got seen by way more people than we'll ever know because it was streamed through Netflix, which you're reaching like Antarctica with that. So that is Mudbound for Dee Reese, another female filmmaker. You've had worked with several, Lona, Sarah Gavron with Suffragette, Dee, and I'm sure I may be forgetting others. Just what was the appeal here, playing a very unhappily married woman on a southern farm in the years before and after World War II?
I mean, I thought it was a fascinating time in American history, and I hadn't sort of seen it in that way before. I couldn't imagine heroes coming home from war and being treated any less than heroes just because of the color of their skin. It was so shocking to think about. And I thought Dee was such an incredible filmmaker, and I loved Pariah so much. I thought it was such a good film and such clear, brilliant storytelling with such honest performances in. So I just sort of saw Pariah and thought, she's going to make a really good film next, and I really want to work with her on it. I probably would have made tea to be on that film. So yeah, it was just I suppose it wasn't initially the role, really. I mean, I really enjoyed playing the role, and I worked with fantastic actors, but it was the more experience of being part of a vision of Dee's and working with Rachel Morrison, who was incredible.
Right. Yeah. First female ever nominated for Best Cinematography Oscar.
Yeah.
And may get it again this year for Black Panther. So that's amazing.
She should do.
Yeah. And the final pre-Wildlife thing is about the theater again, because this year, actually, I think it may have, I guess we're both London and New York this year, off Broadway.
Yeah,
for Dennis Kelly's Girls and Boys, one woman show, 100 uninterrupted minutes, going to some pretty dark places. If people didn't see it, they can listen to it on Audible. What made it worth it to you to put yourself through that particular theatrical challenge? And then also, if you would care to share, I know that you've talked on Late Night a little bit, but it's not actually funny at all. You had to talk about suffering for art. You had a shitty thing happen on the first preview night.
Yeah.
So I'll leave that to you.
I mean, it was, you know, I think I'd read a couple of one-woman shows before, and the writing had never been, you know, it's a daunting prospect to be on the stage on your own. And I'd never read anything that sort of had the strong enough writing to convince me. And I read Dennis's play, and I was literally a week away from having my second kid. And obviously the play
deals with
that. And so I was kind of initially worried that it was, first of all, too early to get back to work with my son, but also that it just touched on stuff that was sort of too close to home with having two children. But I met Dennis, and I just thought Dennis was so incredibly smart and wonderful and clever. And Lindsay's such a great director. And the Royal Court is really my favorite place in the world to work. So I did it, and I found it absolutely terrifying. And the rehearsal process was really, really hard. And a week before we went on, I still didn't know all the words. And I remember getting to the first dress rehearsal, and I did about half the play, and then I called it off and kind of sort of took a minute. And then I realized that I couldn't do the show if I was wearing shoes and that I had to take my shoes off.
Why did that affect things?
I don't know. Because there was a kind of choreography to it that you needed to be kind of nimble on your feet, and it didn't feel you could, because, you know, I was sort of doing a monologue and then the curtain would go up and I would be interacting with these invisible children that the audience couldn't see, and miming picking them up and feeding them and carrying them around the room. And there was something about doing that in shoes that just felt really wrong. But anyway, when I took my shoes off, suddenly I could kind of do it, and it was fine. And then I loved the run in London. And I mean, it was like a tightrope walk doing a one-man show. You kind of can't quite believe you've got to the other side without falling off. And then we took it to the Minetta Lane in New York, and on the first preview, it was one of the last transitions of the play where I had to push a stroller back into the set behind me and then turn around and carry on with the monologue in the blackout. And the curtain, there was a mistiming, and the curtain came down and hit my head.
It was like a
wooden or steel? Or
it's a wooden sort of canvas thing, but 300 pounds counterweighted. Oh, so it hit me on the head and I was so shocked that I just, you know, and it was in the blackout. So I just turned around and smoothed my hair and carried on. And I did the last 20 minutes of the show. And then when I came off, it was just this pounding pain and pressure in the top of my head. And Bradley Cooper had so sweetly come to see the first preview because he was leaving town and he couldn't stay. And, you know, he's come to see my work before. He's always incredibly supportive. But, you know, I don't really know him all that well. And anyway, so my dressing room was this sort of, you know, it was tiny, the Manetta Lane. And, you know, it's a sofa and a dressing table. And then it's not even a, it's just a wall partition, but there's no full wall. And so I was sort of sitting on the floor crying about my head. And he was sitting on the other side.
This is after the show.
Yeah. And he was sitting on the sofa outside. And I was sort of crying on the floor saying my head hurts so much. And finally, I kind of knew he was there and I had to acknowledge it. So I said, like, Bradley, please come in. And he came down and he was like a doctor and he took me to the emergency room. But then I was concussed for about 2.5 weeks afterwards. Oh, so we cancelled 4 shows to sort of get me back on my feet. And then basically all I could do for the first 2 weeks of the run was the show. So I couldn't look at my phone, watch TV, read a book, or do really anything during the day because I needed kind of my brain to work to remember all the words. Right. And, you know, so yeah, that was an interesting start.
You're better.
I'm better. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Thanks.
Jesus. Well, all right. So that brings us to something that must have been filmed before any of that.
Yeah.
Because it premiered at Sundance in January. That is Wildlife, adapted from Richard Ford's 1990 novel, co-written for the screen by Zoe Kazan and Paul Dano, directed by Paul Dano, I think first film as director. Mm-hmm. You're playing Jeanette, a young wife, mother of a teenager. Mm-hmm. In 1960 Montana, you and Zoe and Paul and you and Jake all go back a lot, right?
Yeah. So I met Zoe. Zoe and I played Masha and Nina, respectively, 10 years ago this autumn in The Seagull.
Yeah.
And I met Paul then as well. And then I met Jake shooting Brothers, I think not long after that.
And did you always know this was a story that Paul and Zoe wanted to tell? How did you first hear that it was coming together?
No, I had no idea. I mean, I'd said to Zoe for years, you know, because she's such a brilliant writer and she'd written so many great plays and screenplays. And I said to her, like, we've got to do something else together. So I was, every time we hung out, I'd always sort of tease her about writing something that we could do together, be in together. But I had no idea about Wildlife. And yeah, it was like 2 years ago and Paul called me up and he said, I'm going to send you a script and just read it and, you know, let me know if you like it, whatever. And he sent it to me and I read it and called him back about 90 minutes later and said, thank you for offering me this job. Yes, please.
Do you know why Paul sent it to you?
Why he sent it to me?
I'll read you a little quote here if the answer. He said, this was one of his recent interviews. Quote, having seen Carrie on stage versus certain film roles, I think part of the impulse was it would be really fun to see Carrie be a lot messier. Close quote. What do you think that means?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I think the Coen brothers said something similar about having me swear and be kind of moody. But I think Paul's seen more of my stage work, which is probably more in that kind of messy zone. I don't know. I think I couldn't believe he'd entrusted me with it, to be honest. I thought she was such a difficult, interesting part. I felt very lucky to have gotten the opportunity to do it at all. So it was immediate. I just said immediately yes. And not long after that, it all kind of came together.
A big topic of discussion, we did a Q&A after one of the screenings of this movie, I know it's come up elsewhere, is the likability or not of this character, quote-unquote likability. She does some things that not many women are shown doing in movies without having to face some sort of comeuppance through the years. I know you sort of bristle at the likability thing, so I want to ask you about that. But for you, do you have to find something to like or relate to about a character in order to play her?
Yeah, I think so. I think I have to empathize with all the parts that I play. I've never not liked any of them. I mean, I really like Jean in Inside Llewyn Davis. I think she's hilarious. And I actually never thought about whether people like or don't like a part. And I kind of lean into the unlikable things. I like the unlikable things about Bathsheba because that's all, you know, we all have slightly crap aspects to our personality as much as we try and pretend that we don't, and that's what makes us real human beings. So I didn't really think about whether Jeanette was likable or not. I suppose that's why it came as quite a shock when people started shouting at me in Q&A's.
How could you do this? Yeah. Tell Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah, where's Jake? That guy was very keen to see what Jake was, which is hilarious.
So beyond studying the script by Paul and Zoe and speaking to them about it, did you feel there was anything that you could or should do to prepare to play this one?
It's a funny kind of thing. I mean, no, I suppose is the short answer.
The bit
of cha-cha dancing. Right. I mean, I understood the period to a degree. It's something, you know, I had done a couple of 60s films, a couple of 50s films, so I kind of knew that time period relatively well. But no, I think, you know, also I had a luxury of time before I had two kids, and I had one then. But, you know, I suppose with the short period that we had between the film being greenlit and us going, there was not like vast amounts of time to a huge amount. I had a one-year-old, so... In retrospect, I wonder if there was something kind of freeing and fun about actually not being bogged down by too much research and stuff. Yeah.
But I guess, not that this would be research, but in your own mind, did you at least have to resolve, in order to play somebody who's essentially falling out of love with her husband, do you have to understand what caused her to fall in love with him in the first place?
Yeah, and actually, Jake and I figured a lot of that stuff out over text message because we're professionals.
Yeah, well, you know what? I think Daniel Day-Lewis and Sally Field did that prepping for Lincoln. They were in character texting.
Yeah. So Jake and I were like texting each other about our wedding and stuff because he wasn't with us in Montana when we started shooting. Right. But no, but you know, joking aside, the logic of the choices that she made, I had to be completely clear on. And that was something that we did work out broadly before we started shooting. And then we kind of finessed it as we went through. And I can explain to you, like scene by scene, why she's doing what she's doing. Because I think if you play someone out of control, but you don't know what you're doing, it can be a complete mess. So every choice that she makes in that film made perfect sense to me before I did it.
I'm sure Bill Camp doesn't want any answers. He's just happy it happened.
His character. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So you said that actually the scariest part was acting in front of people that you've known so long and so well. I mean, I guess you'd done that with Kira. Isn't it funny that, you know, you can go and act knowing that any untold number of thousands or, you know, larger number of people are going to see it, but you care about the four people that are
it's
there
always
with
it's the same in theater. I can't ever know if anyone is in the audience because I'm terrible. I had it with Tom Sturridge on Far From the Madding Crowd as well, because Tom and I've known each other since we were 18, and that felt very weird to act in front of him. But yeah, and also it was like, you know, with Paul as a director, I genuinely felt like Paul could do a pretty good job of playing Jeanette. Like, he's such a good actor. So on day one, I was like, oh man, I don't even know if this is, you know, you should do this. I'm completely messing it up. So it was because Paul is such, and Zoe, they're both such extraordinary actors, as well as having their other skills, that I felt, that felt intimidating. But actually, I got over that pretty quickly, and then it was really fun.
Had you ever been directed by another actor before? I'm trying to think.
No.
Is there any actual inherent advantage to that?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think I've been very lucky. I've worked with lots of directors who are really intuitive and thoughtful about acting. But I think Paul could see, and Paul also knowing my work and knowing the things that I whinge about and get insecure about, he was quite good at, you know, what Paul was really good at was identifying when I was holding back a bit, because I will always kind of lean towards restraint and do less. And he was really good at finding those moments and sort of encouraging me to do more.
Yeah. Well, without divulging any kind of major plot points there, I will just say that the movie has been rolling out at all these, basically every festival of this year. The big ones, we can say Cannes, Toronto, New York as examples. What's the rollout of this film been like? And then just as sort of a thought exercise here, would your character, Jeanette, have actually been a happier person if she were at that same time and place in her life, but living in the world today?
So the rollout of the film has been since January in Sundance, and that has been so fun because we are all really good friends who don't see each other very much because they live in New York and I live in London. So actually getting to go to Cannes together and getting to go to Toronto and be in all those quite kind of funny, intimidating rooms, we have had a really nice time, and we've had a really nice time talking about the film because we love it. That has been really amazing. I think there was discussion about bringing the film into the present day simply for budget reasons, just because it would be so much easier to make it now. But I think there were added constraints on women, obviously, but they still exist today. So there's definitely a version of this film that exists. And what has been most striking has been this conversation about unlikability and what our expectations of women and men are on screen and how people have reacted so strongly to seeing a woman being less than perfect.
Well, that was even the thing that, you know, Obama, who I'll speak for myself, I love, but he got, you know, he took a lot of flack for saying when he was up against Hillary in 2008, you know, oh, you're likable enough, Hillary, basically dismissing that same thing as if there, you know, I think there is maybe a different standard for, I think certainly a different standard for women than men to this day, as far as how you, you know, I know the latest thing is, why aren't you smiling?
Yeah, like, right? I know.
But,
yeah.
So anyway, last couple things. Is there any rhyme or reason why so many of your best performances, including the one in Wildlife, are in period pieces?
There's no rhyme or reason.
Just happened to work out.
Those are the best jobs that have come along. So I've been aching to do something contemporary, but you know, they're just the best parts and I can't walk away from them. But there's been no design to the period stuff at all.
Last thing, if you had to model the rest of your career after someone else's, you know, somebody that you, it sounds like you love Judi Dench, but I think you do different, you've had very different ways into your career. So I think she didn't even act in films until way later. So I guess, is there somebody though who you look to and you're like, if I could go along a similar trajectory, that would be great by me?
Probably Rachel Weisz.
Oh yeah.
I could probably list like 15 women, but I think my sensibilities lie most closely with her in terms of the choices that she's made.
So the favorite?
I haven't seen it yet. I'm dying to see it.
Her best thing in a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank
Appreciate
you so
it.
Much.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.